Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Remorse, Finding Joy Through Honest Apology, by Stephen Crippen. Narrated by Lyle Blaker. Preface. I have attended hundreds of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings over the past 9 years, and I have documentation of my attendance at the first few hundred in the form of court-ordered meeting slips. About halfway through each meeting, the secretary says something like, "It's time for our seventh tradition," and starts passing a basket around the room for monetary donations. The seventh tradition is, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. If you were court-ordered to attend AA meetings, as I was for a year beginning in May 2013, you would place your blank attendance slip, I got mine from my outpatient rehab clinic, into the basket along with your few dollars. After the secretary collected the basket and counted the money, they signed the slips, put them in the basket, and sent them back around the room. These seventh tradition baskets remind me of offering plates at churches and were early objects of reflection for me in my efforts to make theological sense of my recovery from alcoholism. The church offering plates typically are fancier, sometimes even lined with red velvet. One of them, in my history of church-going, and to my own amusement, has 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 7b carved along its ornate wooden edge. God loves a cheerful giver. Another church I served pours all the collected money into soft maroon velvet bags, lending a dignified elegance to their presentation at the altar. Despite these stylistic differences, church offering plates are sent around their rooms at about the same time as the AA baskets, approximately halfway through the service or meeting. Both are used as part of an organization's effort to support itself through the financial commitments of its members. The contributions they collect for both groups are generally understood to be expressions of gratitude, not tuition or admission. They support not-for-profit organizations that serve a spiritual, if not necessarily religious, purpose. Yet the people who pass offering plates are usually upstairs in church buildings, and those who drop a few bucks into an AA basket usually gather downstairs or in a less attractive room down a hall. The upstairs people are generally more comfortable with, and in many cases enthusiastic about, theology and religion. On the other hand, many people in recovery find little or no use for theology, religion, or churches, and have experienced faith communities as either unhelpfully judgmental or, in happier stories, ridiculously irrelevant. The AA literature is deliberately non-sectarian. There is even a reassuring chapter titled "To Agnostics" in Alcoholics Anonymous, the primary text of AA, usually called the Big Book. The organization takes great pains to welcome those who have no faith or have been harmed by people of faith. And yet AA was created with the help of an Episcopal priest, and the ethical framework of AA and other 12-step groups would be broadly recognizable to the upstairs people who attend the churches, synagogues, and mosques that lend their meeting spaces to these gatherings. This personal experience in AA, alongside my church life, began my years-long journey of reflection, reading, and writing about remorse. I was particularly intrigued that the AA program of recovery offers great spiritual benefits for those who are willing to confront and work with their own wrongdoing, and yet all the religious and sectarian sources for the spiritual program have been carefully scrubbed. Now, there are positive reasons for this. AA is expressly not only for Christians, let alone Christians of particular denominations. AA is for everyone who desires to stop drinking, and an explicit religious framework, Christian or not, would immediately frustrate that purpose. And AA began in the 1930s, when most Christian churches in the Midwestern cities, where AA first took hold, may not have welcomed honest and open discussion of alcohol problems. Finally, even alcoholics like me, who were deeply comfortable with organized religion, can find it refreshing and surprisingly helpful to do personal spiritual work, like making a list of persons we have harmed and becoming willing to make amends to them, outside of the usual constructs of church, theology, and prayer. Sometimes it just feels cleaner, simpler, more honest, to do all that work by following a basic list of tasks that focuses exclusively on practical matters. But the upstairs people need this too, I often thought. For a few years in my early recovery, I attended AA meetings in the parish hall of the same congregation I served as a deacon. I would be upstairs on Sunday mornings and downstairs on Monday evenings. I once attended an AA meeting and saw my own handwriting on sheets of flip chart paper we had used the day before in a spiritual reflection exercise. I knew instinctively that the people I served on Sunday mornings and the people I joined on Monday evenings all needed to do what the Monday evening people were doing. That particular church was fairly good at encouraging its members to confront their own wrongdoing, but I don't think I've served one congregation in my long history of lay and clergy ministry that comes close to the AA standard. In AA, everyone publicly acknowledges they are there because of their wrongdoing and because they hope to find peace and recovery by directly confronting it and making things right. A Theology of Recovery. By the time I marked my fourth sobriety anniversary, May 13, 2017, I was packing our house for our move to Virginia, where I planned to attend seminary in formation for the Episcopal priesthood. At that time, I told myself, I want to write a theology of recovery. I entered seminary with this ambition and soon found a systematic theology professor who eventually became my thesis advisor. At our first advising meeting, I brought books on the topic of recovery to her office. They were good books. The most prominent author was Gerald May, who wrote eloquently about spirituality and addiction. But my advisor told me that I would have to go deeper in my theological work on the topic. The books I brought to her office approached the topic pastorally, usually with great effectiveness, and were useful for people seeking comfort and good counsel about the many problems of addiction. But my task was different. I wanted to do systematic theology on the human experience of addiction and recovery. I wanted to explore the topic as a fundamental problem of faith, like the problem of innocent suffering or the problems of sin and death. To bridge the upstairs and downstairs worlds of church and AA, I would need to find their common ground. As a therapist, I had given much thought over the years to substance abuse and recovery. But as I walked the road of my own recovery, my worlds began to converge. My personal experience of recovery became and remains a major source of theological insight and a lens for reading and understanding the Bible. Of course, other pastors, theologians, and therapists have reflected on addiction and recovery from theological and biblical perspectives. I have heard many faith leaders say, "Everyone is addicted to something," in their hope that more and more people would do more of the work and receive the spiritual benefits that recovery from substance abuse offers. Addiction has even, I think accurately, been framed as a form of idolatry, a theological category of human misbehavior for which Jewish teachers and faith leaders offer particularly insightful wisdom. In the wake of an Episcopal bishop's drunk driving arrest and subsequent conviction for manslaughter in late 2014, many Episcopalians began reflecting on the shared problem of addiction that can develop in large systems like congregations and even dioceses. Addiction is often rightly front and center as a major theological topic. Nevertheless, as I began writing what I originally had called A Theology of Recovery, I slowly realized that my topic was broader. When I had sat in AA meetings thinking, "The upstairs people need this too," I wasn't thinking about their need for recovery from addiction, even though that particular need was so central to my own experience. I was thinking about the universal human need to admit and work on our wrongdoing, of various kinds, of all kinds. Many churches I know are not good at working on wrongdoing. We mumble our confessions most Sundays and hear that God has forgiven us, but we tend not to dwell on the topic. People in mainline churches can be bashful about their faith, particularly the texts and rituals that focus on wrongdoing, because it can seem not only uncool but actively harmful. Perhaps we are afraid that others will see our church as judgmental, one of the problem churches, the very churches one hears a lot about in AA. As a priest responsible for choosing which confession in the Book of Common Prayer we will use in worship, I once received a complaint that the particular confession I had chosen was deeply upsetting because it implied, in this person's view, that the gathered faithful should be ashamed of themselves. The phrase they took issue with was, "the evil we have done and the evil done on our behalf." The person said they wanted to run screaming from the room when the time came for us to recite this confession. For both theological and pastoral reasons, I sympathize with this worshiper's reaction. In many of my sermons and other writings, I insist that I do not want to shame anyone, and I will reflect on shame in this book as well, holding it in sharp contrast to healthy and grace-filled remorse. And yet, when the day came for me to start writing my thesis and I decided to simply start writing something, anything, to get the first words on the blank page of my laptop, I wrote this paragraph, which survived nearly intact in the final thesis. We should be ashamed of ourselves. Someone is to blame, and that person should take responsibility for their own wrongdoing. Ambivalent, or worse, non-existent remorse mocks the victim and fraudulently exonerates the offender, damaging the humanity of both. Hasty, facile appeals to grace and forgiveness, or even the well-intentioned, empathetic sentiment, "Well, we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God," may inflict further trauma upon everyone involved, while revealing the ulterior motive of those who rush to pardon, a desire to deny the brutal truth of what happened and avoid the terrible questions about humanity and God that haunt those who confront the truth. If the victim is dead, particularly if that death was caused by the offense, hasty pastoral reassurance of God's love and compassion for the killer could inflict further harm on the victim's survivors, driving them yet further from the everlasting arms of God. But terrible acts need not generate a body count to be terrible. A wicked word devastates. A mean-spirited rejection traumatizes. A selfish theft, even a petty one, destroys trust and deprives the victim of serenity. We should be ashamed of ourselves. Remorse matters. The parishioner who complained about my choice of a confession text would likely, and perhaps justifiably, critique me for trying to have it both ways. I don't want to make people feel shame, and I take pains to differentiate chronic shame from healthy remorse, rejecting the former as harmful. And yet I began my first lengthy theological exploration of remorse with the sentence, "We should be ashamed of ourselves," and I left it in. But I did attempt to explain myself in a footnote, and perhaps the footnote would encourage my parishioner and you who are listening to this now to stay with me. Here's the footnote. This paragraph was difficult, if oddly gratifying, to write. It pushes harshly against internal urges to reassure congregants in the pews, to announce good news, to simply be liked. This thesis is, in its essence, an attempt to notice those urges, acknowledge their usefulness, and gently but firmly move them to one side so that a more profound, if excruciating in all senses of that word, good news may be heard and proclaimed. My goal is to shock my reader, and myself too, out of the usual habit of resisting the work of remorse. I kept "we should be ashamed of ourselves" as my first sentence because there is a real difference between the words ashamed and shame. And the former word, ashamed, can be part of a healthy emotional response to wrongdoing. Shame, or more accurately, chronic shame, is a problematic and even neurotic response to one's own wrongdoing. Or worse, chronic shame is traumatically and abusively imposed on an innocent person by another wrongdoer. But if one merely says, "I feel ashamed," that can be a way of expressing healthy remorse, or perhaps just the first, most powerful emotional experience of remorse. Beginning with "we should be ashamed of ourselves" is worth the trouble of language clarification, because many people are instinctively, even actively resistant to the topic of and the work of remorse. And talking about shame can help us sort out what's healthy and what's not, rather than simply resisting the whole topic altogether. Ultimately, remorse is deeply grace-filled and beneficial. Distinguishing it from chronic shame is worth the trouble. Remorse is the task, even the calling of the wrongdoer. Remorse is a royal road to profound grace and fullness of joy for anyone who recognizes this simple truth. I did this thing, and I should not have done it. So many spiritual communities, so many families, so many individual lives are torn apart by unrepaired actions, by the failure of human beings to hold themselves accountable for misbehaviors both great and small. Even if forgiveness is not offered, even if it is not asked for, even if there can be no way to undo what has been done, even then, the human being bears remorse on the shield of their soul and receives from God grace upon grace. This book aims to help faith leaders whose congregants long for this grace and need only learn how to begin. Why remorse? Because of bad behavior. As I said earlier, I was court-ordered to attend AA meetings, which began my years-long preoccupation with remorse. The first long night and day of my recovery, a day of terrible anguish, was also a day of personal resurrection. A bit after midnight, on Monday, May 13, 2013, I looked through my driver's side window and saw a police officer beckoning me to roll down the window. I complied. I have a distinct memory of that moment. I somehow have a memory that I was parked at 6th Avenue and McGraw Street in the Queen Anne neighborhood of Seattle, a few blocks from my house. The cop wanted me to get out of the car. My next memory was being in the police station and taking a breathalyzer test. I should say that I think I remember this. I can't be entirely sure, because the fact that I took the test and the fact that its results, 0.217, were so alarming, captured my imagination for many months after that night. I definitely remember being handcuffed in a cell at the police station, standing up, swaying, and beginning to awaken to my surroundings and my predicament. I remember, too, that the cell was painted a garish yellow. I was inside a bright yellow box. My memories after that slowly came into sharper focus. Slowly. I was in a cab, and I wondered why we were heading south on I-5 toward Seattle. I later learned we were traveling north. I vaguely remember telling the cab driver how to turn onto my street on West Queen Anne. I remember paying with a credit card. I did not yet know that I didn't have my license with me and that I had left my checkbook open on the passenger seat of our car, which was impounded. I remember ringing the doorbell, and I remember waiting for many minutes until my husband came to the door, let me in, and went back upstairs. I followed him upstairs, looked at the bed, and by now was fully conscious of what had happened. I had been arrested for driving under the influence. It was nearly 3 a.m., and I had been released on my own recognizance. I felt a deep, staggering punch of shame. I did not want to go to bed. I remember thinking to myself that I did not deserve to sleep in our bed. I went back downstairs and passed out on the floor of my home office. I woke up sometime after 6 a.m. Our younger dog ran downstairs, took a quick look at me, and scampered back up to his dog bed on the main floor. That was a wrenching day of hangover symptoms, telephone calls, and the first steps in a long journey of recovery. I hadn't remembered bringing it home with me, but the police report was on our kitchen counter. I began to read it. I discovered by reading the report that I had not been anywhere close to 6th and McGraw when I was stopped by the police. I had been on Martin Luther King Boulevard and Othello Street in South Seattle, not far from the South Precinct where the cop had brought me to be booked. I read that the cop had stopped the field sobriety tests for safety reasons, implying that if he had continued, I might have fallen and hurt myself. I read that I was compliant with the officer's commands. I later reflected deeply on this compliance. I interpret it as my first truly sober behavior in my recovery, the earliest sign that God's grace was at work in me. I felt slight bruises, really just stress marks on my wrists where the handcuffs had been. I called my bishop. I was a deacon at that point and had been for about 2.5 years. My bishop was compassionate and pastoral. He said, "You take care of yourself today. I mean it. Take care of yourself." He talked briefly about how this could become public, but was unlikely to cause much of a stir. I was a clergy person, but I wasn't a high-profile one, and to my unending, overwhelming relief, no one had been hurt. Still, it's possible that it could draw attention. If that happened, my bishop wanted me to know that I would have his support. I felt cared for in that phone call. I felt deep gratitude. I remember spending parts of the day in the fetal position under the covers in bed. I had allowed myself, in the light of day, to return to the bed. I threw up my lunch. I made a phone call to the impound lot to be sure I knew how we could recover the car. I suspected that I should not drive, even though it was several days too early for the State Department of Vehicles to revoke my license. I texted my husband and asked him to take the bus down to the impound lot to get the car. When he came back with the car, I was relieved to see that it was undamaged. I called my priest. I will never forget this call. I told her what happened and how scared and upset I was. "I love you," she said. "I love the strong parts of you, and I love the weak parts of you, and I love how they come together in one person." All these years later, this statement remains stitched on my heart. It is the statement of a pastor and theologian, a teacher and priest. It is gospel. It is good news. That night, I went to my first AA meeting. Days, weeks, months, years later, this day, May 13, 2013, continues to be my day of resurrection. This is the day I was reborn. Why remorse? Because of deep relief. My earliest days of sobriety were filled with fear, but also tremendous relief. I was able to sleep through the night and awaken without a hangover. Even in the first couple of weeks, when resentment surged powerfully, "What am I supposed to do now?" I whined that first Friday night when I couldn't have a cocktail, and I was a cranky, irritable client at an outpatient rehab center. Even then, I couldn't help feeling relieved. I no longer had to drink. I was no longer going to get into trouble by drinking. I was on my way toward health. But I was also owning up to what I had done. I told my lawyer I wanted deferred prosecution. I did not want a misdemeanor on my record. I readily admitted that I had been drunk driving, as if I could deny it, and I agreed that if the city of Seattle gave me deferred prosecution, I would follow the requirements and suffer the consequences if I reoffended. I felt so good to simply admit that I had behaved badly. This book is about the deep relief, the deep and joyful relief that comes from healthy remorse. It approaches remorse with a simpler, more visceral word, sorry. We often feel sorry, and we just as often say, or at least should say, "I'm sorry." But in this book, we will do four things related to the word sorry. We will feel sorry, think sorry, say sorry, and do sorry. We feel sorry. Remorse is a feeling, or really a cluster of feelings. One can feel sorry for someone, though that is a wholly different feeling and use of the word. We think sorry. Remorse is a series of thoughts, thoughts that become a thought process and even result in a cognitive shift. In remorse, we change our minds and see things and ourselves in a new way. We then say sorry. Remorse often, but not always, includes apologies, and at its best, those apologies are tremendously powerful and helpful to the persons we harmed. And then we do sorry. We make amends, sometimes directly to the person we harmed, other times by living our lives in a new and better way. As you listen to this book, I encourage you to notice your resistance to what you are hearing and to be curious about it. Like my parishioner who was upset about a Sunday morning confession, you might find the work of remorse brings up painful memories, particularly memories of being shamed. Again, shaming someone for their misbehavior, or worse, shaming them simply because of some aspect of their identity, is directly opposed to the purpose of this book. When we do the healthy work of remorse, we fully cast aside chronic shame as the evil and abusive injury that it is. Remorse is precisely the opposite of chronic shame. When we do the work of remorse, we are participating more deeply in the grace of God, and we are employing the noblest dimensions of ourselves. Couples therapist David Schnark, who encourages couples to focus on their best instincts and qualities, says this: "Only the best in us can talk about the worst in us, because the worst in us denies its own existence. Only the best in us can do the work of remorse, and in that work, God restores our human dignity even more wondrously than it was before we did something we should not have done. Remorse offers bountiful grace and great joy." Chapter 1. Feeling Sorry. In late 2015, 2.5 years into recovery, I flew into St. Paul, Minnesota for my uncle's funeral. It was winter. I hadn't lived close to my dad and siblings for many years by this time. 18 years. I was used to flying in for a few days, seeing people in a whirlwind of visits and flying out. Like all families, we have patterns of conflict and triangulation that are tried and true. Emails were flying as various siblings planned various parts of the weekend, the funeral, the reception, and other gatherings. I began replying to emails as I was rushing around, multitasking. One of my siblings had written a tribute to our uncle, and I was commenting on their work. I said something snarky about how it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. So hey, that's a win. And then I pressed send. And only then did I realize that this sibling was on the to list for the email. I panicked. I literally shuddered under a flood of adrenaline and fear. I immediately texted a couple of people on my list of coalition siblings, the little list of siblings I am closest to. I told them I messed up, badly, and that this other sibling got my email. One of the members of my coalition called the sibling I had heard and talked over what happened, part of the triangulation pattern in our family. But I knew I had to do something. I had to be direct and call the sibling myself and apologize. And that's it. Just an apology. No appeal for forgiveness, no excuses. I recalled step 10 in AA, which says, "We continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it." I knew what I had to do. I made the call and said I was sorry. "I am really sorry. I really am," I said. "There's no excuse for what I did. I was being snarky and insensitive, and you didn't deserve that." I listened as the sibling told me their experience of my email in a somewhat broken voice. They said that they were hurt in part because they have a long history of writing and writing well, and were shocked that someone in the family would so blithely make fun of their writing. And it also hurt because they too were close to our uncle, arguably closer than most of us, not that this sibling was asserting that. I apologized again. I said I wanted to do anything I could to make things right. My sibling was gracious and said that it was enough that we talked about it, and we agreed to move on. As the rest of the weekend went by, we talked, a little stiffly, but in a friendly way. The problem was resolved. I felt better, much better. I had done step 10 with my sibling. We continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I flew home feeling that I had not behaved well over the weekend, but that I had at least made repairs for my bad behavior. I often return to this story years later with chagrin, but also with a deeper sense of satisfaction that what was broken was repaired. Stories like this, with all the feelings that freight them, are often what we think of when we...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?